I next met with Dr. Don Dizon, who began by commenting on a recently published study in which he was the principal investigator that evaluated one of the most controversial questions in the field, the role of surgical staging by a second procedure in patients with apparently early-stage disease who will receive adjuvant chemotherapy.
The clinical scenario that was the basis for this paper was a woman who went in with her general gynecologist to surgery for what looked like an uncomplicated, normal-looking pelvic mass, and essentially looked fine through a Fannin-Steele incision, which is a low incision, took out the ovary, and lo and behold, there's cancer in it. So in that case, there was a lot of debate, and usually it's a national problem of whether or not you need to go in and stage, which is standard of care, or if you're going to give chemotherapy anyway, is there any further benefit to going back to the OR if you've made that decision already?
And I guess also now in the age of much more sophisticated imaging technology than when a lot of these algorithms were developed.
Correct. We tend to think of CT scan as very reliable for ovary cancer, but the thing that CTs aren't very good at picking at is sort of that miliary disease that can stud the bowel that you may not be aware of. And certainly, you know, the data for surgery in ovarian cancer is pretty conclusive that if you go in and you stage the patient completely and if you can remove all of the disease, the prognosis is excellent, even for advanced stage disease. So the question was, in someone who looks like they have early ovary disease, what is the benefit for staging if you're going to give that patient chemotherapy? So that was the basis of this paper.
Just to interject one other thing about imaging, what about PET CT and ovary?
Right. PET CT is pretty good. It's still not an approved indication for PET. A lot of places are getting it covered, and certainly I have patients who are being followed by PET CT. Still, the imaging threshold is about a centimeter. So the question of whether or not you can reliably trust a negative PET scan is still unclear. You know, the way it's used in breast makes more sense. You get a PET pre-treatment, it's positive. You can follow that thing for FDG activity. If you don't have those baseline studies in ovary, it's hard to tell what's positive and what's negative and what the implications are.
So what did you do in the trial?
So in this trial, it was a retrospective study of the folks we had at Brown. So we looked at our experience looking at women who had an early stage ovarian cancer and were able to stratify patients who underwent surgery and those who didn't have surgery and who went to chemotherapy. And the ones who went to chemotherapy, high-grade disease, clear cell histology, some of these more concerning features. And we looked at those populations, ones who had surgery, then had chemo, and those who just had chemotherapy and no further surgery. And it looked like at the outcome was they did the same. There was no benefit for the surgery if you're going to give those women chemo.
And so right now, in terms of clinical implications of this, what would you say they are?
Well, I think it's provocative, number one. I don't think it's definitive because obviously it's retrospective and there's an inherent problem with retrospective studies being conclusive. But I think the suggestion is that if it's a woman who's going to need chemotherapy anyway and doesn't want to go back to the operating room or maybe looking at a delay of the start of systemic treatment, it may be reasonable to either delay the surgery until after chemotherapy is completed or not do the surgery at all and give the woman chemotherapy and follow closely. Our standard of care still at Brown is to offer surgical staging for early stage disease. But I think we look at this data and say, well, benefits and risks being what they are, I think the more important treatment at this point is systemic chemotherapy, and let's get that started.
How have your colleagues in gynecologic oncology responded to this?
Personally speaking, although I don't do surgery, I was surprised by the results. I actually anticipated that surgery still had a prognostic role, even with apparent early stage disease. But there were randomized trials done in Europe that looked at this question in a very different way of what is the role of chemotherapy in early stage disease. And then the take home points from those studies were that surgically staged patients may not need chemotherapy, but if you did not stage the person completely, chemotherapy saved those women. So we went about it in the other way, but the results are essentially the same. So I think for the community, it was reassuring. I don't think it has changed standard of care, which would still be to offer surgery to those women. And those women who don't go through surgery for the reasons we talked about, I think everyone feels a little bit better.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is actually after the ASCO meeting, I found out about there's some work presented there on pertuzumab in ovarian cancer. And I've been asking people about this because it looked really interesting, but I haven't been able to quite put it all together yet. And I see that you were involved with that work. So I'm really excited for you to take a shot at explaining this to me because it seems really interesting. Of course, so much is going on in breast cancer right now, HER2 positive disease. Can you talk about what we know about this in ovarian cancer?
Right. So pertuzumab is very confusing at first blush because essentially it's targeting HER2, but it is not an anti-HER2 antibody like trastuzumab. The class of drugs that it falls into is actually a HER dimerization inhibitor. So what that means is, as opposed to trastuzumab, which just blocks HER2 itself and blocks the downstream pathways from HER2, this blocks HER2 from associating with other members of its family. So in that sense, it blocks HER2, HER3 dimers from forming, and that one being probably the most potent pairing, but also HER2 from binding other members. Much of the story with pertuzumab is probably falling in with the HER2, HER3 dimerization story, insofar as it does not need a HER2 overexpression to be effective. And the clinical trials that thus far have been done in ovarian cancer in a group with platinum-resistant, previously treated, mind you, ovarian cancer, there is a suggestion that women who had low HER3 mRNA levels were the group of women that not only had a poor prognosis on just chemotherapy, in the case of the trial gemcitabine, but also may have a higher benefit from the treatment of pertuzumab with gemcitabine in combination. So what we're looking at is the HER2 story in breast that might be mirrored in ovarian cancer, but as opposed to HER2 overexpression being the marker for activity, it would be low HER3 mRNA levels as the marker of activity for pertuzumab in ovarian cancer.
And that's kind of where I was getting confused. Why would low HER3 level predict response to this?
I have to say that to the credit for the company, they had planned to do this biomarker analysis as part of the trial because HER3 has a ligand that helps activate HER3 to bind HER2 called heregulin, right? But of their markers, the one thing that fell out was that HER3 levels low versus high, it appeared that activity and response was better when HER3 mRNA was low. So the hypothesis right now is that HER3 may be overactive on the cell surface, and that's leading to negative feedback at the level of mRNA. So HER3 low might be the byproduct of activity at the surface.
The whole issue of where HER2 fits in terms of cancer and cancer treatment, in my mind, is also something that's starting to get even a little more confusing. I know you're involved with breast cancer, and you have these data out there that Soon Paik looked at, suggesting in the adjuvant setting there's benefit from trastuzumab in people who are would be considered HER2 negative. And I, in a recent email communication with him, they're doing a round robin on that that's going to be presented soon. And I think it's probably going to hold up.
Right. It's pretty provocative, I think, in breast. I mean, I know that Soon Paik is really trying very hard to validate his data using multiple pathologists to see if that's really what has happened. But, I mean, as you know, in breast, we're still debating what exactly HER2 positive means. There's IHC versus FISH.
Right,
the
right.
ratio has changed from 1.5 to 2.2 to call something overexpressed. And I think when it comes to ovary, we have an opportunity to learn what has happened with HER2 in breast cancer and really quantify and define what exactly we're talking about with low HER3, because that could be a moving target as well.
The other thing was it's been considered that there are not that many ovarian tumors that are, quote, truly HER2 positive. So again, I guess it's just the question of whether the oncogene addiction model, the Sleeman sort of HER2 thing, is really what this is all about, or it's maybe more complicated.
I think probably what we're learning now, it's far more complicated. I think because of the revolution in breast oncology with HER2 and trastuzumab, everyone has focused really their efforts on HER2 and not really talked about receptors binding in terms of getting activated in the normal cellular mechanisms and as well as in cancer-related mechanisms. And I think right now with HER3 coming up, the importance of binding is now being appreciated. And the downstream pathways, PI3K with AKT, that can be driven by the HER2, HER3 dimerization process is going to be probably more of the story. So I do think we're going to see a lot more about this family. And I think the HER2 story is going to get much more complicated.
Any sort of guesses slash predictions where we're going to be 5 or 10 years from now in terms of anti-HER2 type strategies in ovarian cancer? Do you think they're going to be used for a significant number of patients or not really?
Well, I think that gets down again to the exploratory biomarkers that we're sort of looking at now, which is this low HER3 story. If you look at a population and arbitrarily define 50% of them as low HER3, then it's going to affect half of the population who have recurrent ovarian cancer. But if that HER3 low is something that is validated and affects 30% certainly, then you know a smaller number will be affected. I think the importance of this is pertuzumab may be the first agent beyond breast oncology, beyond CML, where we can actually target a specific population of women who relapse and fulfill this mission that we all have talked about of individualizing and tailoring anti-cancer treatment.
Let's go on to your cases, and the first gets into the issue of adjuvant treatment in a young woman, 43 years old. Can you go through that?
Yep. So this case number one is a 43-year-old woman who had presented with abdominal pain and bloating. She had an elevated CA-125, normal is anywhere between 21 at our institution, but standard across the country is about 35. Hers was elevated to 2,000. And she went to the operating room and underwent a successful, what we term optimal resection for stage 3C ovarian cancer. So optimal resection means that there was less than a centimeter residual disease at the end of the surgical approach. So in this case, it's very typical. Obviously, there's about 20,000 cases of ovarian cancer annually in the U.S., and the majority of those are going to present late because we don't have really great screening strategies for early ovarian cancer. And certainly a case like this, standard of care would be to use a combination of carboplatin and paclitaxel in the adjuvant context. I think the important thing about adjuvant therapies for ovarian cancer is that we haven't seen, in terms of intravenous systemic therapy, there has not been much in the way of revolutions in advancing that. I point to a recent trial performed by Gynecologic Oncology Group, GOG-182, which was an international trial, 5 arms, comparing sequential doublets as well as triplet therapy, and was open to women with stage 3 or 4 disease. And ultimately, compared with the standard of carboplatin and Taxol, there was no improvements in progression for your overall survival. And in that trial, overall survival was about 40 months. But I think for this patient who's optimally resected stage 3C, it does bring in to the discussion the role of intraperitoneal therapy. And at Brown, we're a large proponent of intraperitoneal therapy as adjuvant treatment. There have been multiple trials. The most recent one was from the Gynecologic Oncology Group, GOG-172. And it was presented, and first author of that was Deborah Armstrong from Johns Hopkins. And it compared an IP-containing regimen to intravenous therapy using cisplatin and Taxol as its standard. And the experimental arm containing intraperitoneal cisplatin on day 1 as well as intraperitoneal paclitaxel on day 8 showed an overall survival that was significantly improved with intraperitoneal therapy of over 5 years. And it was the first time in a randomized trial that survival endpoints went beyond that. Obviously, the major problems that have really hindered intraperitoneal therapy from becoming more fully utilized is the toxicity. And in fact, if you look at this trial, 42% of patients completed 6 cycles of IP-containing treatment, and a lot of folks fell off due to toxicity of therapy or port complications. So I think the challenge for those of us who do gynecologic oncology is to try to improve on intraperitoneal therapy regimens in order to improve the success rates of getting people through 6 cycles. But in our minds at Brown, in my mind personally, I think intraperitoneal therapy should be considered the standard of care for young women like this with optimally resected disease.
When you sit down with a patient like this, what do you say in terms of what to expect in terms of side effects and toxicity of the two approaches? And is there sort of an age limit where you sort of pull back from offering it?
Well, I think when you look at carboplatin and Taxol, the first thing that I tell women is that there's no long-lasting side effects to be expected. All right, so that sort of sets it up for the discussion that follows. So you have alopecia, but your hair will grow back. You can have a numbness and tingling develop, but we expect that to resolve. Might take a year, but it should resolve. You should have effects on your blood counts, but those two are transient, and that they should, again, at the end of the day, 5 years from now, your immune system should be just fine. I think when you come to intraperitoneal therapy, the discussions form more complicated. Cisplatin and paclitaxel have neuropathy as an overlapping side effect. And certainly on GOG-182, the last trial of intraperitoneal therapy, if you look at all the toxicities, the one that lasted was neuropathy. So there's a risk of long-lasting side effects there. The side effects of intraperitoneal therapy are the feeling of abdominal distension, which can be very uncomfortable, can also be associated with pain. And then there's the risk of having the catheter in your abdomen, the risk of perforation, the risk that it will malrotate and not function. You were talking about a treatment time where the intraperitoneal fluid flows by gravity. So a woman can be sitting in the chair for 3 to 6 hours waiting for this thing to instill. So all of those go into the discussion. I think the nausea is much harder with intraperitoneal containing therapy. But also, I think physicians need to know that the follow-up needs to be much more aggressive almost, because we need to watch for renal dysfunction in women getting intraperitoneal cisplatin. And sometimes that shows up 2 days later, and you need to follow your patients to make sure that they're staying hydrated, because the cisplatin needs to be removed, and renal toxicity is not an uncommon thing, unfortunately.
Is there an age limit whereby you sort of pull back from offering this?
I don't have a hard and fast age limit. I personally look at performance status as the bigger indication. If I have a 75-year-old woman who's golfing every day and, 4 days and she was up and walking from a huge optimal debulking procedure, and in whom someone I think might be alive for another 3 years had she not had cancer or longer, then it's someone I'm going to offer IP therapy to. But, if patients have had a huge bowel resection, obviously if they have ongoing neuropathy from other reasons, or if they're elderly and they look their age, I will shy away from offering intraperitoneal treatment.
Our CME group does these patterns of care studies. Yeah. We've done a lot of them, breast, colon, prostate. We're now on hematologic malignancies. And we've never done one in ovary. I think it'd be really interesting.
Yeah, that would be great.
What do you think we would see in terms of intraperitoneal therapy in the community? Do you think most docs in community-based practice, not gynecologic oncology, but general oncology or general gynecologic oncology, actually do it?
No. I think if you look even in a city like Providence, where women are getting treated for ovary beyond our realm in the program, this is not a discussion that medical oncologists have. And I think the reason is that intraperitoneal therapy is not a new thing. It's not a new concept. And it's really, quite frankly, it's not that sexy. But it is more difficult and it's more time in a chair. So I think with all of that, I don't think, outside from certain centers who are really dedicated to it, it's not something that's going to be widely used. And I think you'd find that in your patterns of care.
It sounds like maybe it isn't something that should be done occasionally.
Right. Exactly. I absolutely agree with that.
So I guess then the question is, are these same docs, when they see patients, offering them a referral to a center to get treated?
I'd like to say, and I'd like to believe that more often than not, that's exactly what's happening. But, it's very clear to me that there are women with ovarian cancer who are staying with their local surgeons or their gynecologists and not getting staged. And there are women referred to very good community oncologists, very good general academic oncologists who don't see a lot of ovary, and they're not having this discussion about intraperitoneal therapy.
So what happened with this woman?
This woman did receive intravenous intraperitoneal therapy and did very well on treatment. She didn't have much in the way of toxicity in terms of neuropathy. We were able to get her through 6 cycles, and she is continuing in follow-up. She is now, without evidence of disease, going on 26 months.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
What are some of the clinical trials that are out there right now that are looking at these questions and patients in this situation, or trials that have been already accrued but we don't have results from?
A lot of centers are doing trials in the adjuvant treatment of ovarian cancer, incorporating the role of biologics. And one of the trials I was involved with in partnership with Dr. Richard Penson and Dr. Ursula Matalonis' group at Harvard was a trial of carboplatin taxol with bevacizumab as adjuvant treatment in advanced ovarian cancer. And that manuscript has been written and it's submitted. And the 3-year progression-free survival is 58% in our study of 62 patients. The gynecologic oncology group is already already doing a randomized trial, GOG number 218, looking at the addition of bevacizumab to a carboplatin and Taxol backbone. And certainly we are doing, through the gynecologic oncology group, trying to hone in on other ways to deliver intraperitoneal therapy. And the phase one clinical trials group through the GOG has a series of trials looking at intraperitoneal approaches, some of which are going to also look at the question of intraperitoneal-based therapies in addition to or associated with the biologic therapy and anti-angiogenic treatment.
I guess when we think about bevacizumab, I think about wound healing. Right. There's a bowel perforation story, and I actually wanted to ask you about that. Mm-hmm. What do we know right now about safety and toxicity when bevacizumab is integrated with intraperitoneal therapy?
We don't know much. I mean, there's the specialized program for ovarian cancer research. The SPORG program is conducting a phase one intergroup trial looking at IP therapy with bevacizumab. But again, this is purely investigational, and there's no outcome data or safety data yet available for how to incorporate that with intraperitoneal treatment.
So can you kind of go through the available clinical trial data right now, and for that matter, translational work in terms of bevacizumab and ovarian cancer, and what your take is on it?
Yeah, so bevacizumab is being explored in every possible disease setting in ovarian cancer. Probably the first one that showed that it should be considered highly exciting was performed in the gynecologic oncology group in women who had relapsed ovarian cancer. These women had two prior therapies before they could go on this trial, and it was a single-agent study of bevacizumab. And remember, most of the trials that have showed activity with bevacizumab have been in combination with chemotherapy. I'm pointing to the breast cancer trial of Taxol and bevacizumab, paclitaxel bevacizumab, even capecitabine and bevacizumab had high response rates. So what differed this trial from others that were done was it was a single-agent trial in a relapsed population with ovarian cancer. And we had powered the study to look at prolongation of progression-free survival at 6 months as the primary endpoint. And that was almost 40%. But what was even more interesting was that we saw actual responders. So with an anti-angiogenic drug in ovarian cancer in women who had prior therapies, it had almost a 20% response. And the toxicity that was reported in that trial, which was GOG-170D, was fairly mild. It was fairly manageable. High blood pressure was an issue. So based on that, a couple of other trials have since come out. And
I'm kind of curious what your take is in terms of the biology of ovarian cancer and why maybe we see these responses where we don't see them in a whole lot of other tumors.
Right. Well, I think it might have something, honestly, to do with the tumor microenvironment. I mean, ovarian cancer is very unusual, and unlike breast or prostate, relapses tend to occur intra-abdominally. So there's something about the peritoneal cavity that predisposes to relapse and regrowth of tumor. So perhaps there's local VEGF factors that are in play there, or it might be the host signaling to the tumor, but specifically in the abdomen. And perhaps that's where these VEGF agents are seeing their most effect. Obviously, if you have a high concentration of VEGF within the intra-abdominal cavity or even within the tumor microenvironment, wherever it's growing, and you're able to block that, maybe that's why you're seeing these effects. What's curious, and I can't really explain why we saw responses and not just increases in stable disease, was that we actually saw shrinkage, which biologically I wouldn't expect to see with an anti-VEGF agent because CTs aren't functional imaging. So if you see a tumor and it starts to starve itself, maybe you'll be left with a scarred mass, which is not necessarily smaller. So a RECIST criteria would consider that stable.
The other part of the sort of biologic puzzle is this curious thing about the impact of anti-VEGF therapy and bevacizumab in terms of ascites itself.
Right. I think it's fascinating. You know, I've certainly seen women bedbound recover their lives with bevacizumab, bedbound because of refractory ascites. And where it works, these women, it's really the Herceptin story in the very beginning when these women got Herceptin and rediscovered their life and were just resuscitated. And you were seeing the same effect with bevacizumab and ovarian cancer for women who respond in terms of their ascites. Again, it might be we're oversimplifying the effects of bevacizumab, We keep thinking of it as anti-VEGF, but there may be additional effects that have yet to be characterized.
I mean, do we know what happens when you give bevacizumab to somebody who has ascites from a non-malignant cause, cirrhosis or whatever?
Right. No, we don't. We don't know what happens there. I mean, I'm not familiar with any data of bevacizumab being given for non-oncological induced ascites.
So getting back more to the actual clinical data, can you talk a little bit more about what else has been found in terms of not only benefits but also risk, and particularly about bowel perforation?
Right. So based on Dr. Berger's study for the GOG, which was this trial, the company launched a second trial. This is very curious because it was the exact same criteria in terms of who they were looking at. It was women who had recurrent ovarian cancer who were deemed platinum resistant, but unlike the first trial where the cap was at two prior therapies, the company-sponsored trial capped it at three prior therapies. And that trial showed a similar response rate, about 16%, and six-month progression-free survival was only 27%, but the study was stopped early. And it was stopped early because of a safety signal, in which case more women, 12%, so over 1 in 10 of the women who participated, suffered a bowel perforation. And there's been a lot of talk about what predisposed these women to bowel perforations and might have been the prior lines of therapy. In the Berger study, there was two prior lines was your eligibility. Here was three prior lines for your eligibility. And I can't say that we know for certain, A, what the exact incidence is, but we certainly can't really tell you for certain what the predisposing factors are. On the heels of this other trial was one from the California Consortium. The principal investigator was Agustin Garcia, and he did metronomic cyclophosphamide with bevacizumab. So this idea of low-dose chemotherapy alongside bevacizumab. And again, the results were very consistent. It was a 28% response rate there, six-month progression-free survival of almost 60%. So all of these trials are showing very encouraging results with bevacizumab. What we still are unclear about and are very nervous about is what is the true rate of perforation? It's anywhere between 0 and 12%. And we're looking at a woman who is looking at this as a potential therapy. It's not a comfortable thing to be able to say to a woman that you can't put your finger on exactly what that risk is.
Do you think in some way, if you could sort of factor in the amount of surgery that's been done in the abdomen, the amount of tumor that's in the abdomen, that somehow it'd be correlated? I mean, I note that I guess in colon, they saw some bowel perforations in the advanced disease setting, and I think little, if any, in the adjuvant setting.
Right, right. That was my impression, too.
And that kind of follows that paradigm. Is that, do you think, the way this is going to shake out?
I think so. I'm involved in other anti-angiogenic clinical trials. They've sort of looked at the data with bevacizumab, and we have done it, too, as part of our clinical review, and there's certain types of patients who may or maybe should not be getting bevacizumab, and heavily treated patients, probably not a great idea. So a lot of these new anti-angiogenic trials are capping prior treatments to two lines, for example. History of bowel obstructions or current bowel obstructions are being excluded from a lot of these trials going forward. History of bowel studding, even in the absence of bowel obstruction, but, you know, omental implants or carcinomatosis, some patients are being steered away from or not being offered bevacizumab on that basis. Some of us are actually steering clear of offering it to, you mentioned this early, but the elderly patient, maybe not a great candidate, maybe not so much because of the bowel perforation, but certainly the risk of arterial thromboembolic events and the hypertension in that age group maybe is not such a great idea in a context of a disease where in relapse, you're really talking about preserving quality of life. So heavily treated bowel obstructions, carcinomatosis, these are some things we're thinking about.
You know, the issue of non-protocol use of bevacizumab has come up with a lot of different tumors over the last few years. And, of course, cost and reimbursement always kind of get factored in. But putting that aside, just kind of looking at the clinical science right now and assuming that you could get it paid for, in what situations, if any, do you think bevacizumab is a reasonable non-protocol option in ovarian cancer?
I think it's very reasonable to use bevacizumab in the relapsed patient who may have refractory ascites as its only site of disease, which is not an uncommon finding. I look at it as an option for a younger patient, and by younger I mean under the age of maybe 70, all right, who has disease and has progressed on, you know, 3 lines of therapy, I think it's reasonable there as well.
As a single agent or with chemo?
I use it as a single agent right now. I haven't used combination bevacizumab with IV therapy. Sometimes I've done the oral cyclophosphamide with bevacizumab, but I've started to think that the data that shows oral cyclophosphamide metronomically really made that much of an impact is lacking.
And if your 43-year-old woman that we talked about before came in with a whole bunch of journal articles, I don't know if she was that kind of patient or not, but there's plenty of them out there, that's for sure.
Right.
And said, I see there's this study out there where they're using bevacizumab. I see all this promising stuff. It looks like it's not going to make me sick. Would you be willing to give it to me along with chemo or after chemo or in some way integrated in my treatment without being in a study?
In the setting, if she were to relapse?
No, right now.
Oh, right now? I would not, no.
I mean, when she first presented.
I wouldn't give it in that situation because obviously if you're looking at, and you know, quite frankly, what I tell women when I meet with them for the first time after surgery, I do tell them we have a chance to cure you of your disease with what we have available now. So in a curative setting, I'm not going to use something experimental, particularly when there's concern about toxicity.
And I think that's a pretty standard answer that we've heard in all the tumors where bevacizumab has been used and is being studied in the adjuvant setting.
Right.
Let's talk about your second patient, the 45-year-old woman.
All right. This was a 45-year-old woman I treated who had an original diagnosis of stage 3C ovarian cancer about 3 years ago, at which point she underwent a successful surgery followed by adjuvant carboplatin and paclitaxel. That completed in 2006. And now, 13 months later, she has a rise in her CA-125 to 33 from her nadir, or her lowest value of 13. A CT scan is completely negative at that time, so she was not treated, and she was just followed with this rising CA-125. And about 9 months later, she presented with abdominal pain, and a CT scan at that time showed evidence of recurrent disease in the abdomen. She underwent a biopsy of a nodule in the omentum, and this was positive for metastatic disease. So this case illustrates the definition of platinum-free intervals and how that really impacts on our treatment decisions. And so right now, we're considering women with platinum resistance if they have a relapse at 6 months, and anyone going beyond 6 months is considered to be platinum sensitive. In terms of that duration, platinum sensitive beyond 12 months is really considered prognostically better than platinum sensitive at 8 months. So it's this sort of 6 to 12 month interval. Sometimes you'll see referred to as an intermediate platinum sensitive recurrence. But for someone like this, who I actually define her platinum sensitivity not by the rise in CA-125, but by the evolution of her disease and the point in which I'm going to start treatment again. So it's really her treatment-free interval in this patient defined her platinum-free interval, in which case this was about 2 years.
So what did you present or think about as options for her, and what would you have thought about if it had been an earlier relapse that you would have considered platinum resistant?
Right. So I think the story with platinum sensitive disease is twofold. One, this is a group who can re-respond to the same drugs you gave them before, which is, again, a feature of ovarian cancer management, which is not really replicated elsewhere in oncology. So if someone goes beyond 6 months, carboplatin-based therapy is once more a standard of care recommendation. But for someone like this, who is platinum sensitive, the other question that comes up and should come up with everyone in this situation is there a role for surgical resection? So this sort of secondary debulking question is, again, something to consider. And data from Memorial Sloan Kettering suggests that if you're able to completely resect recurrent disease, that can translate into a progression-free survival advantage. So those are the two discussions I would be having with a patient who relapsed at 2 years, such as she did. A, are you a candidate for surgery? And if so, can we get it all out? And two, regardless of what question number one is, which platinum-based combination would we want to use?
So what happened with this patient?
So with this patient, she had multiple sites of disease and was not anxious to undergo further surgery. So we did not proceed with a surgical option. And we retreated her with a platinum-based combination using carboplatin with gemcitabine. It has FDA approval for treatment for platinum-sensitive disease, and it was based on a randomized trial performed through Germany. And it is a very reasonable alternative to the other standard, which is carboplatin and paclitaxel. Nice thing about carboplatin and gemcitabine is you don't lose your hair, which in the relapse setting may be important for a patient. It was for this patient. You spare them the side effects of neuropathy once more. But the trade-off is it's much harder on the bone marrow, and the treatment time is different. So instead of coming in once every 21 days, you're coming in twice every 21 days for treatment with carboplatin and gemcitabine. So today, if she had come in, I should also point out that I would have offered her a clinical trial. So Gynecologic Oncology Group Trial 213 is asking the question, does surgery in women with platinum-sensitive relapse matter? So women who are candidates for surgery are randomized to surgery or no surgery. And then there's a second randomization to carboplatin and Taxol versus carboplatin and Taxol with bevacizumab. Once more. So they're asking this question again in relapse platinum sensitive disease.
How do patients respond? I mean, randomization to surgery versus not sounds pretty tricky.
It's true for a lot of clinical trials. It depends on how the scenario is presented to them. I think 3 years ago, I would have said, let's send you to your gynecologic oncologist. Let's do your surgery once more, because I believe that surgery plays a role in platinum sensitive recurrence treatment. If you present it in such a way that the data that backs up that belief really isn't that strong, then it lends credence to doing the clinical trial. And I think presented that way, we've been successful in encouraging participation on 213.
So what happened with this patient?
So she underwent carboplatin and gemcitabine and did very well. But as is typical for women who have relapsed ovarian cancer, her remission lasted 8 months, which is far shorter than the 24 months she went before. And she's continuing further therapy. I chose not to retreat her with platinum with her third recurrence. And at that point, we went to single agent therapy. And at that point, I chose Doxil.
And so she's on that now?
Correct.
And how's she doing?
She's doing very well. She's doing very well.
How long has she been under treatment with Doxil?
So she's been on what's pegylated liposomal doxorubicin now for 14 months.
Any side effects or toxicity?
We did have to do a dose reduction because of palmar plantar erythrodysesthesia. So she had some skin peeling and tenderness as well as erythema on her hands. And we did a dose reduction to 30 per square meter every 4 weeks, but she's actually doing quite well on that. Unlike doxorubicin in the breast cancer patient, we are not finding any evidence that prolonged treatment with pegylated liposomal doxorubicin causes cardiac dysfunction. However, we are checking it annually on patients who are on Doxil long-term.
What's happened in terms of her tumor status?
Her tumor status has become stable. So her best response was a partial remission after 6 months. I'm treating to progression, in which case she has not progressed yet. The nice thing about carboplatin and Doxil is that there's so little crossover in terms of the toxicity that it's probably going to be much more tolerable in the long run.
How about the third patient you were going to present?
Okay, so the 68-year-old woman had originally been diagnosed with advanced stage 3C ovarian cancer back in 2002, and she relapsed about 12 months later, and she is heavily treated. So since 2003, she has received Doxil, gemcitabine, weekly topotecan, weekly carboplatin, weekly paclitaxel, hexamethylamine, docetaxel, and even endocrine therapy in the forms of both tamoxifen and anastrozole. At this point, she has continued progressive abdominal distension with ascites, which has begun to affect her quality of life, her breathing, and her ability to live independently. So this is a typical patient who's looking at the natural history of this disease as it continues to get worse and worse. And like we had talked about earlier, her ascites is becoming the one reason that she's having a reduction in her quality of life. So this is a case where your options are best supportive care, which could also include serial paracentesis and putting in a shunt that she can open and drain her own ascites, or offering further therapy very cautiously considering the use of bevacizumab to control her ascites. Yeah. So in this case, I discussed it very significantly with her. And actually, one of the things we discussed at the time I treated her was the potential that it may not be covered by her insurance company. So I actually laid out cost implications of using bevacizumab in the event it was not covered by her insurance company. And she really wanted to try it because her quality of life was being so diminished. And in her case, bevacizumab dramatically improved her ascites, and she was able to prepare Thanksgiving dinner for a family of 10.
Wow.
You know, it was unbelievable. She stayed on bevacizumab for 14 months.
Wow. Are you going to tell me the insurance company didn't pay for it?
Her insurance company did not pay for it.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Even though it worked.
It worked brilliantly.
So she paid for it out of pocket?
We are still fighting for her to get that coverage.
Wow.
And what we're hoping now is that there's been a recent local coverage determination from CMS covering off-label use of bevacizumab for ovarian cancer that we're using to try to argue this case.
Interesting. You know, that's not the first time I've heard that scenario. Not so much about bevacizumab, but although I think I have heard about bevacizumab, about payment being denied for a therapy that clearly worked, and then you think, well, how can they not pay for it? But then, well, then suppose it didn't work. Does that mean they shouldn't pay for it?
The thing that makes it really frustrating is that it's sort of taking the focus away from patient care.
Right. Now, in this case, clinically, how long did it take before you started to see improvement in ascites?
It took 8 weeks.
Wow.
Before it was controlled.
And what happened to tumor markers or a CAT scan?
Her CA-125 actually reflected that response, but I can say over the 14 months she was on treatment, her CA-125 would actually go up. I'd get a CAT scan and things actually look fine. She never had omental carcinomatosis as her disease site. It was her, she had nodal disease on CT. So I think that's one of the reasons she was able to stay on therapy for so long. She didn't have one of these concerning things, despite the fact she was heavily treated.
So now did the nodes decrease in size?
The nodes stayed stable. But her CA-125 didn't appear to be that great of a marker of what she was clinically doing.
And when you actually looked at her, when she started out, she was bedbound?
She was coming in a wheelchair, yeah. She was not good at getting out of bed at all.
And then after 8 weeks or when she hit her maximal response, how much weight had she lost and what did her belly look like?
Her belly was actually soft for the first time in months. And she had lost about, I'd say, almost 15% of her body weight she had lost from her fluid.
It's always tricky, you know, when you present these sort of anecdotal cases and you think, well, are we being balanced about what we're presenting?
Correct.
But clearly this might not have helped at all. But I guess knowing that there are patients like that, and this is not the first time I've heard about this from an ovarian investigator, I guess it's just important to know it could happen.
It's definitely important to know it could happen. I think the one thing that still gives us pause about using it so liberally is the risk of toxicity not being well understood. One of the little projects I'm doing right now is actually looking at our program's experience on using bevacizumab off-label, profiling what happened with women. Because I can also say this patient had a fantastic response, but we've also seen bevacizumab do very bad things, or patients do very bad things on bevacizumab, I should say.
Such as?
Bowel perforations to the point of surgery and women dying during that hospitalization.
The last thing I want to ask you about is you mentioned that this lady had received tamoxifen and anastrozole, and I wonder if you could just comment on what we know about endocrine therapy of ovarian cancer.
Well, we know that endocrine therapy, well, we know A, estrogen receptors are expressed in ovarian cancer, B, that they seem to have no clinical implications of being there at all, yet that tamoxifen can sometimes be associated with drops in the CA-125 and can be a very well-tolerated treatment in the patient who you feel does not require chemotherapy. So I sort of look at the anti-estrogen therapies as a bridge to chemotherapy and sort of maintaining a good quality of life in the context of having a low burden of relapse disease.
What do we know about estrogen and progesterone receptors in ovarian cancer in response to hormone therapy?
There's not been a good correlation at all between the presence of estrogen receptors and response to endocrine therapy. The aromatase inhibitors didn't appear to have that high of a response rate on clinical trials. Again, the utilization may be more in terms of grade 1 tumors of the ovary or low malignant potential tumors in whom chemotherapy doesn't work very well, probably because they're not very proliferative tumors. So in these tumors, endocrine therapy may play more of a role. But at this point, for ovarian cancer, its role in the treatment of relapse disease is fairly limited.